The Trial by Franz Kafka, continued. Disc 2.
Of course, said Kay, but it can go too far.
It can indeed, said Frau Grubach. You're certainly right there, Herr Kay. And perhaps it has in this case. I certainly have no wish to slander Fräulein Bürstner. She's a fine and dear young woman, friendly, neat, punctual, and industrious. I appreciate all that. But it's true she should show more pride and more reserve. I've already seen her twice this month in other neighbourhoods, and each time with a different man. I find it very embarrassing. I swear to the dear Lord I've mentioned it to no one but you, Herr Kay, but there's no getting around it. I'll have to speak to the young woman about it. And that's not the only thing I find suspicious about her.
You're totally off track, said Kay, scarcely able to conceal his fury. It seems you've misunderstood my remarks about the young woman. That's not at all what I meant. In fact, I warn you frankly not to say anything to her. You're completely mistaken. I know the young woman quite well, and there's no truth at all in what you've said. But perhaps I'm going too far. I don't wish to stand in your way. Say whatever you want to her. Good night.
Herr Kay, said Frau Grubach imploringly, and rushed after Kay to his door, which he had already opened. I really don't want to speak to her. Of course, I'll first keep an eye on her a while longer. You're the only one I've told what I know. After all, it's surely in the boarder's best interest to try to run a clean house, and that's all I'm trying to do.
Clean! Kay cried through the crack in the door. If you want to run a clean house, you'll have to start by giving me notice. Then he slammed the door shut, paying no attention to the timid knocks that followed. However, since he didn't feel like sleeping, he decided to stay up and use the opportunity to find out when Fräulein Bürstner would arrive. It might even be possible, though hardly proper, to exchange a few words with her. As he lay in the window, rubbing his weary eyes, he even thought for a moment of punishing Frau Grubach by talking Fräulein Bürstner into joining him in giving notice. But he saw at once that this would be a gross overreaction, and even suspected himself of wishing to change lodgings because of the morning's events. Nothing would be more irrational, and above all, more pointless and contemptible. When he grew tired of looking out onto the empty street, he lay down on the divan, having opened the door to the hall slightly so that he could see anyone entering the lodgings directly from where he was lying. He lay on the divan smoking a cigar until around 11. After that, he couldn't hold out there any longer, and went instead out into the hall for a little while, as if he could speed up Fräulein Bürstner's arrival that way. He had no particular desire to see her, he couldn't even quite remember what she looked like. But now he wanted to talk to her, and he was annoyed that by coming home so late she was bringing disturbance and disarray to this day's end as well. And it was her fault he hadn't eaten anything that evening, and that he'd skipped his intended visit to Elsa that day. Of course, he could make up for both now by going to the wine bar where Elsa worked. He'd do that later, after he had spoken with Fräulein Bürstner. It was past 11:30 when he heard someone on the stairs. Kay, who had been pacing up and down the hall noisily, lost in thought, as if he were in his own room, fled behind his door. It was Fräulein Bürstner returning. Shivering, she pulled a silk shawl around her slim shoulders as she locked the door. In another moment she would be entering her room, which Kay certainly wouldn't be permitted to invade this close to midnight. He had to speak to her now. But unfortunately he'd forgotten to switch on the light in his room, so that when he stepped out of the darkened room it would resemble an assault, and at the very least would give her a real shock. At a loss, and since there was no time to lose, he whispered through the crack in the door,
"Fräulein Bürstner."
It sounded like a plea, not a call.
"Is someone there?"
asked Fräulein Bürstner, and looked around wide-eyed.
"It's me," said Kay, and stepped forward. "Oh, Herr Kay," said Fräulein Bürstner with a smile. "Good evening," and she held out her hand.
"I wanted to have a few words with you. May I do so now?"
"Now?"
asked Fräulein Bürstner.
"Does it have to be now? Isn't that a little unusual?"
"I've been waiting for you since 9 o'clock."
"Well, I was at the theatre. I had no idea you were waiting."
"What I wanted to talk to you about was occasioned by something that occurred just today."
"Well, I really don't mind, except that I'm so tired I'm about to drop. Come into my room for a few minutes, then. We certainly can't talk here. We'll wake everyone up, and that would be even more unpleasant for us than for the others. Wait here till I've lit the lamp in my room, and then turn this light off."
Kay did so, but then remained waiting until Fräulein Bürstner softly invited him in again from her room.
"Sit down," she said,
and pointed toward the ottoman, while she herself remained standing by the bedpost, in spite of her talk of fatigue. She didn't even take off her small hat, which overflowed with flowers.
"So, what is it you want? I'm really curious."
She crossed her legs lightly. "Perhaps you'll say," Kay began, "that the matter wasn't so pressing that we had to talk about it now, but—"
"I never listen to long preliminaries," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"That makes my task easier," said Kay. "Your room was slightly disturbed today, and in a sense it was my fault. It was done by strangers and against my will, and yet, as I say, it was my fault. That's what I wanted to ask your pardon for."
"My room?" asked Fräulein Bürstner, scrutinizing Kay instead of the room.
"That's right," said Kay. And now they both looked each other in the eyes for the first time. "Exactly how it happened isn't worth talking about."
"But that's what's really interesting," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"No," said Kay.
"Well," said Fräulein Bürstner, "I don't want to pry into secrets. If you claim it's of no interest, I won't bother to argue. I gladly grant the pardon you seek, particularly since I see no trace of any disorder."
She made a tour of the room, her hands flat and low on her hips. She stopped in front of the mat with the photographs.
"Yes, look," she cried out. "My photos have been all mixed up. That's really annoying. Someone's been in my room without permission."
Kay nodded and silently cursed the clerk Kaminer, who could never control his stupid, senseless fidgeting.
"I find it odd," said Fräulein Bürstner, "to be forced to forbid you to do something your own conscience should forbid, namely to enter my room when I'm away."
"But I explain to you, Fräulein," said Kay, going over to the photographs as well. "I'm not the one who took liberties with your photographs. But since you don't believe me, I must confess that the Commission of Inquiry brought along three bank clerks, and that one of them, whom I'll have dismissed from the bank at the first opportunity, probably handled your photographs."
"Yes, there was a Commission of Inquiry here," Kay added, since the young woman was staring at him with a questioning look.
"Because of you?" the young woman asked.
"Yes," Kay replied.
"No," the young woman cried with a laugh.
"Oh, yes," said Kay. "Do you think I'm guiltless, then?"
"Well, guiltless," said the young woman. "I don't want to make a hasty judgment that might possibly have serious consequences, and I don't really know you, but it does seem that you'd have to be a serious criminal to have a commission of inquiry come down on you right from the start. But since you're free, at least I gather from your calm state that you haven't escaped from prison, you can't have committed any serious crime."
"Yes," said Kay. "But it may have been that the Commission of Inquiry realized I'm guiltless, or at least not quite as guilty as they thought."
"Yes, that could be," said Fräulein Bürstner, paying close attention. "You see," said Kay, "you don't have much experience in court matters."
"No, I don't," said Fräulein Bürstner, "and I've often regretted that, because I would like to know everything, and I'm fascinated with court matters. The court has a strange attraction, doesn't it? But I'll certainly be able to increase my knowledge in that area, because I start next month as a secretary in a law firm."
"That's very good," said Kay. "Then you'll be able to help me a little with my trial."
"Perhaps," said Fräulein Bürstner. "Why not? I enjoy using my knowledge."
"I'm serious, too," said Kay, "or at least half serious, like you. It's too minor an affair to bring in a lawyer, but I could use someone to advise me."
"Yes, but if I'm to advise you, I have to know what it's all about," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"That's just the problem," said Kay. "I don't know myself."
"Then you've just been teasing me," said Fräulein Bürstner, exceedingly disappointed. "You hardly needed to pick such a late hour to do it."
And she walked away from the photographs where they had been standing together for so long.
"But, Fräulein," Kay said, "I'm not teasing. Why won't you believe me? I've already told you everything I know, more than I know, in fact, because it wasn't a commission of inquiry. I just called it that because I don't know any other name for it. There was no inquiry. I was simply arrested, but by a commission."
Fräulein Bürstner sat down on her ottoman and laughed again.
"What was it like?" she asked.
"Terrible," said Kay, although now he wasn't thinking about it at all, but was instead totally engrossed by the sight of Fräulein Bürstner, who was resting her head on one hand, her elbow propped on the cushion of the ottoman, while she slowly stroked her hip with the other.
"That's too general," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"What's too general?" Kay asked. Then he came to himself and asked, "Do you want me to show you how it was?" He wanted to move about and yet not leave.
"I'm already tired," said Fräulein Bürstner.
"You got in so late," said Kay.
"And now it ends with reproaches. I deserve it. I should never have let you in, and it wasn't really necessary, as it turned out."
"It was necessary. You'll see that now," said Kay. "May I move the nightstand away from your bed?"
"What an idea!" said Fräulein Bürstner. "Of course you can't."
"Well, then I can't show you," Kay said, all upset, as if this would cause him immense harm.
"Well, if you need it for your performance, then go ahead and move the stand," said Fräulein Bürstner, adding in a faint voice after a pause, "I'm so tired that I'm letting you take more liberties than I should."
Kay placed the little table in the middle of the room and sat down behind it. "You have to visualize the cast of characters. It's very interesting. I'm the inspector. Two guards are sitting over there on the chest. Three young men are standing by the photographs. From the window handle, I'm just noting it in passing, hangs a white blouse. And now the action begins. Oh, I'm forgetting myself, the most important character. I'm standing here in front of the table. The inspector is sitting totally at ease, his legs crossed, his arm hanging down like this from the back of the chair, an unbelievable bore. And now the action really begins. The inspector cries out as if he has to wake me up, practically shouting. Unfortunately, I'll have to shout too, to show you how it was. All he shouts is my name, by the way." Fräulein Bürstner, laughing as she listened, held her finger to her lips to keep Kay from yelling, but it was too late. Kay had entered too deeply into his role.
"Josef Kay," he cried, drawing it out slowly, not, after all, as loudly as he had threatened, yet in such a way that the cry, having suddenly burst forth, seemed to spread only gradually throughout the room.
There was a knock at the door to the adjoining room, a brief, loud series of blows. Fräulein Bürstner turned pale and put her hand to her heart. The shock was even greater for Kay, since for a short while he could think of nothing but that morning's events and the young woman he was reenacting them for. As soon as he came to himself, he sprang to Fräulein Bürstner and took her hand.
"Don't worry," he whispered. "I'll straighten everything out. But who can it be? That's just the living room next door, and no one's sleeping there."
"Oh, yes," Fräulein Bürstner whispered in Kay's ear. "Frau Grubach's nephew has been staying there since yesterday, a captain. There's no other room free at the moment. I'd forgotten about it, too. You had to shout so. That makes me very unhappy."
"There's no reason to be," said Kay, and kissed her on the forehead as she sank back upon the cushion.
"Go, go," she said, and quickly straightened up again. "Go on, go away. What do you want? He's listening at the door. He can hear everything. You're tormenting me."
"I'm not going," said Kay, "until you've calmed down a bit. Come over to the other corner of the room. He can't hear us there." She let him lead her there.
"Just remember," he said, "this may be unpleasant for you, but you're in no danger. You know how Frau Grubach, whose voice will count most, particularly since the captain is her nephew, practically worships me and believes anything I say. She's beholden to me in another way, too, since she's borrowed a large sum from me. I'll accept any suggestion you offer as to why we were together, as long as it's halfway reasonable, and I guarantee I'll get Frau Grubach not only to accept it in public, but to truly and honestly believe it. You needn't spare me in any way. If you want it spread around that I assaulted you, that's what Frau Grubach will be told and what she will believe, without losing confidence in me. That's how devoted she is to me."
Fräulein Bürstner stared silently at the floor in front of her, slumping slightly.
"Why shouldn't Frau Grubach believe that I assaulted you?" Kay added.
He saw before him her hair, parted, tightly drawn reddish hair, gathered together lightly on her neck. He thought she would look up at him, but she spoke without changing her posture.
"Pardon me. It was the sudden knocking that frightened me, not so much the possible consequences of the captain's presence. It was so quiet after you cried out, and then the knocking came. That's why I was so frightened, and I was sitting so close to the door. The knocking was right beside me. I appreciate your suggestions, but I can't accept them. I can take full responsibility for what happens in my room and face anyone. I'm surprised you don't realize the insult to me implicit in your suggestions, along, of course, with your good intentions, which I certainly recognize. But go now. Leave me to myself. I need that more than ever now. The few minutes you requested have turned into more than half an hour."
Kay seized her by the hand and then by the wrist. "You're not mad at me, are you?" he said. She pushed his hand away and answered,
"No, no. I never get angry at anyone."
He reached for her wrist again. She allowed it now and led him to the door. He firmly intended to leave. But at the door, as if he hadn't expected to find one there, he hesitated. Fräulein Bürstner used this moment to free herself, open the door, slip into the hall, and implore Kay softly from there.
"Now come on, please. Look."
She pointed at the captain's door, beneath which a strip of light emerged.
His light is on, and he's amusing himself over us.
I'm coming, said Kay, rushed out, seized her, kissed her on the mouth, then all over her face, like a thirsty animal lapping greedily at a spring it has found at last. Then he kissed her on the neck, right at her throat, and left his lips there for a long time. A noise from the captain's room caused him to look up.
I'll go now, he said. He wanted to call Fraulein Bürstner by her given name, but he didn't know it.
She nodded wearily, allowed him to take her hand for a kiss as she was already half turned away, as if she were unaware of it, and entered her room with bowed head. Shortly thereafter, Kay lay in his bed.
He fell asleep very quickly. Before falling asleep, he reflected briefly on his conduct. He was pleased with it, but was surprised that he didn't feel even more pleased. He was seriously concerned on Fraulein Bürstner's behalf because of the captain. Chapter 3. Initial Inquiry. Kay was informed by telephone that a brief inquiry into his affair would take place the following Sunday. He was notified that such inquiries would now be held on a regular basis, perhaps not every week, but with increasing frequency. On the one hand, it was in the general interest to bring his trial to a rapid conclusion. On the other, the inquiries must be thorough in every respect, yet never last too long due to the strain involved. Therefore, they had selected the expedient of this succession of closely spaced but brief inquiries. Sundays had been chosen for the inquiries to avoid disturbing Kay's professional life. It was assumed he would find this acceptable. If he preferred some other fixed time, they would try their best to accommodate him. For example, the inquiries could be held at night, but Kay probably wouldn't be fresh enough then. At any rate, as long as Kay had no objection, they would stay with Sundays. Of course, he was required to appear. It was probably not really necessary to point that out. He was given the number of the building in which he was to appear. It was a building on a street in a distant suburb Kay had never been to before. Having received this message, Kay hung up the phone without replying. He had resolved at once to go on Sunday. It was clearly necessary. The trial was getting under way, and he had to put up a fight. This initial inquiry must also be the last. He was still standing lost in thought by the phone when he heard the voice of the executive vice president behind him, who wanted to make a phone call, but found Kay blocking the way. "Bad news?" the vice president asked lightly, not because he wanted to know, but to get Kay away from the phone.
"No, no,"
said Kay, stepping aside but not walking off. The vice president picked up the phone and, while waiting to be put through, spoke across the receiver. "May I ask you something, Herr Kay? Will you do me the pleasure of coming to a party on my sailboat Sunday morning? There'll be quite a few people. I'm sure you'll know some of them. Among others, Hasterer, the public prosecutor. Would you like to come? Please do." Kay tried to concentrate on what the vice president was saying. It was not without importance for him, since this invitation from the vice president, with whom he had never got along particularly well, indicated an attempt at reconciliation on the other's part, and showed how important Kay had become to the bank, and how valuable his friendship, or at least his neutrality, must seem to the bank's highest second officer. The invitation humbled the vice president, even if it had merely been delivered across the receiver while waiting for a call to go through. But Kay was forced to humble him a second time by replying, "Thank you very much, but unfortunately I'm busy on Sunday. I have a previous engagement." "Too bad," the vice president said, and returned to his call, which had just been put through. It was no brief conversation, but in his preoccupied state, Kay remained standing by the phone the whole time. It wasn't until the vice president hung up that he came to himself with a start and said, to excuse himself somewhat for having simply stood around, "I just received a call asking me to go somewhere, but they forgot to tell me the time." "Call them back and ask," said the vice president. "It's not that important," said Kay, although in doing so his previous excuse, which was already weak enough, crumbled even further. As they walked away, the vice president talked of other things, and Kay forced himself to answer, but he was really thinking that it would be best to arrive Sunday morning at 9, since that was when courts opened session on workdays. The weather was dull on Sunday, and Kay was very tired, having stayed at the tavern celebrating with the regulars late into the night, so that he almost overslept. He dressed hastily, without having time to think things over or review the various plans he'd worked out during the week, and, skipping breakfast, hurried to the suburb they had indicated.
Strangely enough, although he had little time to look about, he ran across the three clerks who were involved in his affair, Rabensteiner, Kulich, and Kaminer. The first two were riding in a tram that crossed Kay's path, but Kaminer was sitting on the terrace of a coffee-house and, just as Kay was walking by, leaned inquisitively over the railing. They probably all gazed after him, wondering why their supervisor was in such a rush. Some sort of stubbornness had prevented Kay from taking a cab. He had an aversion to even the slightest outside help in this affair of his. He didn't want to enlist anyone's aid and thus initiate them in the matter even distantly. Nor, finally, did he have the least desire to humble himself before the Commission of Inquiry by being overly punctual. Of course, he was now running to get there by 9, if at all possible, although he had not even been given a specific hour at which to appear. He had thought he would recognize the building, even at a distance, by some sign he hadn't visualized precisely, or by some unusual activity at the entrance. But Juliusstrasse, where it was supposedly located, and at the top of which Kay paused for a moment, was flanked on both sides by almost completely identical buildings, tall, grey apartment houses inhabited by the poor. On this Sunday morning, most of the windows were occupied. Men in shirt sleeves leaned there smoking, or held small children with tender care at the windowsill. Other windows were piled high with bedding, above which the dishevelled head of a woman briefly appeared. People called across the street to each other. One such exchange, directly over Kay's head, aroused loud laughter. At regular intervals along the long street, small shops offering various foodstuffs lay below street level, reached by a few steps. Women went in and out of them, or stood on the steps chatting. A fruit vendor, who was offering his wares to the windows above, paying as little attention as Kay, almost knocked him to the ground with his pushcart. Just then a gramophone that had served its time in better sections of the city began to murder a tune. Kay continued down the street, slowly, as if he had plenty of time now, or as if the examining magistrate had seen him from some window and knew he had arrived. It was shortly after 9. The building stretched some distance. It was almost unusually extensive. The entrance gate in particular was high and broad. It was evidently intended for heavy wagons belonging to the various warehouses, now locked shut, which lined the inner courtyard, with signs bearing the names of firms, some of which Kay knew from the bank. Contrary to his normal habit, he was taking close note of all these surface details, and he paused a while at the entrance to the courtyard. On a crate nearby sat a barefoot man reading a newspaper. Two boys rocked back and forth on a handcart. A frail young girl in her nightjacket stood at a pump and gazed at Kay as the water poured into her jug. In one corner of the courtyard, a line with wash to be dried already dangling from it was being stretched between two windows. A man stood below and directed the task with a few shouts. Kay turned to the stairs to find the room for the inquiry, but then paused as he saw three different staircases in the courtyard in addition to the first one. Moreover, a small passage at the other end of the courtyard seemed to lead to a second courtyard. He was annoyed that they hadn't described the location of the room more precisely. He was certainly being treated with strange carelessness or indifference, a point he intended to make loudly and clearly. Then he went up the first set of stairs after all, his mind playing with the memory of the remark the guard Wilhelm had made that the court was attracted by guilt, from which it actually followed that the room for the inquiry would have to be located off whatever stairway Kay chanced to choose. On his way up, he disturbed several children who were playing on the steps and who looked angrily at him as he passed through their midst. "The next time I'm to come," he said to himself, "I'll either have to bring candy to win them over or my cane to flog them." Shortly before reaching the first floor, he even had to pause for a moment until a marble had completed its journey, while two little boys with the pinched faces of grown tramps held him by the trouser legs. If he had wanted to shake them off, he would have had to hurt them, and he feared their cries. On the first floor, the real search began. Since he couldn't simply ask for the commission of inquiry, he invented a carpenter named Lanz. The name occurred to him because Frau Grubach's nephew, the captain, was called that, intending to ask at each apartment if a carpenter named Lanz lived there, hoping to get a chance to look into the rooms. That proved to be easy enough in general, however, since almost all the doors were standing open, with children running in and out. As a rule, they were small, one-window rooms where people cooked as well. A few women held babies in one arm as they worked at the stove with their free hand. Half-grown girls, apparently clad only in smocks, ran busily back and forth. In every room, the beds were still in use, with someone sick or still asleep in them, or people stretched out in their clothes. Kay knocked at the apartments with closed doors and asked if a carpenter named Lance lived there. Generally, a woman would open the door, listen to the question, and turn to someone in the room who rose up from the bed.
"The gentleman wants to know if a carpenter named Lance lives here."
"A carpenter named Lance?" asked the one in the bed.
"Yes," Kay said, despite the fact that the Commission of Inquiry clearly wasn't here, and therefore his task was ended. Several people believed Kay badly needed to find the carpenter Lance, thought long and hard, recalled a carpenter but not one named Lance, remembered a name that bore some faint similarity to Lance, asked their neighbours, or accompanied Kay to some far distant door, where they fancied such a man might possibly be subletting an apartment, or where there was someone who could provide him with better information than they could. In the end, Kay scarcely needed even to ask, but was instead pulled along in this manner from floor to floor. He regretted his plan, which had at first seemed so practical. As he was approaching the fifth floor, he decided to give up the search, took his leave from a friendly young worker who wanted to lead him further upward, and started back down. But then, annoyed once more by the futility of the whole enterprise, he returned and knocked at the first door on the fifth floor. The first thing he saw in the little room was a large wall clock that already showed 10 o'clock. "Does a carpenter named Lance live here?" he asked. "This way, please," said a young woman with shining black eyes, who was washing diapers in a tub, and pointed with her wet hand toward the open door of the adjoining room. Kay thought he had walked into a meeting. A crowd of the most varied sort, no one paid any attention to the newcomer, filled a medium-sized room with two windows, surrounded by an elevated gallery just below the ceiling that was likewise fully occupied, and where people were forced to crouch with their backs and heads pushing against the ceiling. Kay, who found the air too stuffy, stepped out again and said to the young woman, who had probably misunderstood him, "I was looking for a carpenter, a man named Lance." "Yes," said the woman. "Please go on in." Kay might not have obeyed if the woman hadn't walked over to him, grasped the door handle, and said, "I have to lock it after you. No one else is permitted in." "Very sensible," said Kay. "But it's already too crowded." But he went back in anyway. Between two men who were conversing near the door, one of them was going through the motions of counting out money with outstretched hands, the other was looking him sharply in the eye, a hand reached out for Kay. It was a little red-cheeked boy. "Come on, come on," he said. Kay let him lead the way. It turned out that there was indeed a narrow path through the swirling crowd, one that possibly divided two parties. This possibility was further supported by the fact that Kay saw scarcely a face turned toward him in the closest rows on his left and right, but merely the backs of people addressing their words and gestures solely to those in their own party. Most were dressed in black, in old, long, loosely hanging formal coats. This was the only thing Kay found confusing, otherwise he would have taken it all for a local precinct meeting. Kay was led to the other end of the hall, where a small table had been placed at an angle on a low and equally overcrowded platform, and behind the table, near the platform's edge, sat a fat little man, wheezing and chatting with someone standing behind him. The latter was leaning with his elbow on the back of the chair and had crossed his legs, laughing heartily all the while. Now and then he would fling his arms in the air as if he were caricaturing someone. The boy who was leading Kay found it difficult to deliver his message. Twice already he tried to say something, standing on tiptoe, without being noticed by the man above. It was only when one of the people up on the platform drew attention to the boy that the man turned and bent down to listen to his faint report. Then he pulled out his watch and glanced over at Kay. "You should have been here 1 hour and 5 minutes ago," he said. Kay was about to reply, but he didn't have time, for the man had scarcely spoken when a general muttering arose from the right half of the hall. "You should have been here 1 hour and 5 minutes ago," the man repeated more loudly, and glanced down into the hall as well. The muttering immediately grew louder still, and, since the man said nothing more, died out only gradually. It was now much quieter in the hall than it had been when Kay entered. Only the people in the gallery continued making comments. They seemed, as far as one could tell in the semi-darkness, haze, and dust overhead, to be dressed more shabbily than those below. Some of them had brought along cushions that they placed between their heads and the roof of the hall so as not to rub themselves raw. Kay had decided to observe more than speak,
and therefore waived any defence of his supposedly late arrival, merely saying, "I may have arrived late, but I'm here now." A burst of applause followed, once again from the right half of the hall. "These people are easily won over," thought Kay, and was only disturbed by the silence in the left half of the hall, which lay immediately behind him, and from which only thinly scattered applause had arisen. He considered what he might say to win all of them over at once, or if that was not possible, at least to win the others for the time being.
"Yes," said the man, "but now I'm no longer required to examine you."
Again the muttering, but this time mistakenly, for the man waved the people off and continued,
"However, I'll make an exception for today, but such tardiness must not be repeated. And now step forward."
Someone jumped down from the platform to free a space for Kay, and he stepped up into it. He was standing right up against the table. The pressure of the crowd behind him was so great that he had to actively resist if he didn't want to push the examining magistrate's table, and perhaps even the magistrate himself, right off the platform. The examining magistrate wasn't worried about that, however, but sat comfortably enough in his chair and, after a closing remark to the man behind him, reached for a little notebook, the only object on his table. It resembled a school exercise book, old and totally misshapen from constant thumbing.
"So," said the examining magistrate, leafing through the notebook and turning to Kay, as if simply establishing a fact, "you're a house painter."
"No," said Kay. "I'm the chief financial officer of a large bank." This reply was followed by such hearty laughter from the right-hand party below that Kay had to join in. The people propped their hands on their knees, shaken as if by fits of coughing. There were even a few laughing up in the gallery. The examining magistrate, who had become quite angry and was probably powerless to do anything about the people below, tried to compensate for this by jumping up and threatening the gallery, while his ordinarily inconspicuous eyebrows contracted bushy black and large above his eyes. The left half of the hall, however, was still silent, the people standing there in rows, their faces turned toward the platform, listening to the words exchanged above as quietly as to the clamour of the other party, now and then even allowing a few members within their own ranks to go along with the other side. The people in the party on the left, who were in fact less numerous, may have been no more important than those in the party on the right, but their calm demeanour made them appear more so. As Kay now started to speak, he was convinced that he was expressing their thoughts. "Your question, Your Honour, about my being a house painter, and you weren't really asking at all, you were telling me outright, is characteristic of the way these entire proceedings against me are being conducted. You may object that these aren't proceedings at all, and you're certainly right there. They are only proceedings if I recognise them as such. But I do recognise them, for the moment, out of compassion, so to speak. One can only view them compassionately if one chooses to pay any attention to them at all. I'm not saying these proceedings are sloppy, but I would like to propose that description for your own personal consideration." Kay interrupted himself and looked down into the hall. What he had said was harsh, harsher than he had intended, but nonetheless accurate. It should have earned applause here and there, but all was still. They were evidently waiting tensely for what was to come. Perhaps in that silence an outburst was building that would put an end to everything. It was disturbing that the door at the end of the hall now opened, and the young washerwoman, who had probably finished her work, entered, drawing a few glances in spite of her painstaking caution. Only the examining magistrate gave Kay direct cause for joy, for he appeared to have been struck at once by his words. Up to that point he had been standing as he listened, for Kay's speech had caught him by surprise as he rose to admonish the gallery. As Kay now paused, he slowly lowered himself back into his chair, as if hoping to keep anyone from noticing. In an attempt to regain his composure, no doubt, he took out his little notebook again. "It's no use, Your Honour," Kay continued. "Even your little notebook confirms what I'm saying." Pleased that his own calm words alone were to be heard in that strange assembly, Kay even dared to snatch the notebook from the magistrate's hands and lift it in his fingertips by a single centre page, as if he were repelled by it, so that the foxed and spotted leaves filled with closely spaced script hung down on both sides. "These are the records of the examining magistrate," he said, letting the notebook drop to the table. "Just keep reading through them, Your Honour. I really have nothing to fear from this account book, although it's closed to me, since I can barely stand to touch it with the tips of two fingers." It could only be a sign of deep humiliation, or at least so it seemed, that the examining magistrate took the notebook from where it had fallen on the table, tried to put it to rights somewhat, and lifted it to read again. The faces of the people in the front row were turned toward Kay so intently that he gazed down at them for a short time. They were all older men, a few with white beards. Perhaps they were the decisive ones, capable of influencing the whole assembly, men whom even the examining magistrate's humiliation could not stir from the quiescent state they'd fallen into since Kay's speech. "What has happened to me," Kay continued, somewhat more quietly than before, and constantly searching the faces of those on the front row, which made his speech seem slightly disjointed. "What has happened to me is merely a single case, and as such of no particular consequence, since I don't take it very seriously, but it is typical of the proceedings being brought against many people. I speak for them, not for myself." He had instinctively raised his voice. Someone clapped somewhere with raised hands and cried out, "Bravo! Why not? Bravo! And encore, bravo!" Those in the front row pulled at their beards now and then. No one turned around at the cry. Nor did Kay grant it any importance, yet it cheered him. He no longer considered it necessary for everyone to applaud. It was enough that the audience in general was beginning to think the matter over, and that someone was occasionally won over by his words. "I don't seek success as an orator," Kay said with this in mind, "nor could I necessarily achieve it. The examining magistrate is no doubt a much better speaker. After all, it goes with his profession. What I seek is simply a public discussion of a public disgrace. Listen. Around 10 days ago I was arrested. The arrest itself makes me laugh, but that's another matter. I was assaulted in the morning in bed. Perhaps they'd been ordered to arrest some house painter. That can't be ruled out after what the examining magistrate has said. Someone as innocent as I am, but they chose me. The room next door had been taken over by 2 coarse guards. If I had been a dangerous thief, they couldn't have taken better precautions. These guards were corrupt ruffians as well. They talked my ear off. They wanted bribes. They tried to talk me out of my undergarments and clothes under false pretenses. They wanted money, supposedly to bring me breakfast, after they'd shamelessly eaten my own breakfast before my very eyes. And that wasn't all. I was led into a 3rd room to see the inspector. It was the room of a young woman for whom I have the highest respect. Yet I was forced to look on while this room was defiled, so to speak, by the presence of the guards and the inspector, on my account, but through no fault of my own. It wasn't easy to stay calm. However, I managed to, and I asked the inspector quite calmly, if he were here he'd have to confirm that, why I had been arrested. And what was the reply of this inspector, whom I still see before me, sitting on the chair of the young woman I mentioned, the very image of mindless arrogance? Gentlemen, he really had no reply at all. Perhaps he actually knew nothing. He had arrested me, and that was enough for him. He had taken the additional step of bringing to the young lady's room 3 minor employees from my bank, who spent their time fingering photographs, the property of the lady, and mixing them all up. The presence of these employees served another purpose, of course. They were meant, like my landlady and her maid, to spread the news of my arrest, damage my public reputation, and, in particular, to undermine my position at the bank. Well, none of this met with the slightest success. Even my landlady, a very simple person, I pronounce her name in all honour, she's called Frau Grubach, even Frau Grubach was sensible enough to realise that an arrest like that means as little as a mugging on the street by teenage hoodlums. I repeat, the whole affair has merely caused me some unpleasantness and temporary annoyance, but might it not have had more serious consequences as well? As Kay interrupted himself at this point and glanced at the silent magistrate, he thought he noticed him looking at someone in the crowd and giving him a signal. Kay smiled and said, "The examining magistrate here beside me has just given one of you a secret signal, so there are those among you who are being directed from up here. I don't know if the signal is meant to elicit hisses or applause, and I deliberately waive my opportunity to learn what the signal means by having revealed the matter prematurely. It's a matter of complete indifference to me, and I publicly authorize His Honour the examining magistrate to command his paid employees below out loud, rather than by secret signals, and to say something like, 'Now hiss,' and the next time, 'Now clap.'" The examining magistrate shifted about in his chair in embarrassment or impatience. The man behind him, with whom he had been talking earlier, bent down to him again, either to give him some general words of encouragement or to pass on special advice.
The people below conversed quietly but animatedly. The two parties, which had appeared to hold such contrasting opinions before, mingled with one another, some people pointing their fingers at Kay, others at the examining magistrate. The fog-like haze in the room was extremely annoying, even preventing any closer observation of those standing further away. It must have been particularly disturbing for the visitors in the gallery, who were forced, with timid side glances at the examining magistrate, of course, to address questions under their breath to the members of the assembly in order to find out what was happening. The answers were returned equally softly, shielded behind cupped hands. "I'm almost finished," said Kay, striking his fist on the table, since no bell was available, at which the heads of the examining magistrate and his adviser immediately drew apart, startled. "I'm completely detached from this whole affair, so I can judge it calmly. And it will be to your distinct advantage to pay attention, always assuming you care about this so-called court. I suggest that you postpone your mutual discussion of what I'm saying until later, because I don't have much time and will be leaving soon." There was an immediate silence, so completely did Kay now control the assembly. People weren't shouting back and forth as they had at the beginning. They no longer even applauded, but seemed by now convinced or on the verge of being so. "There can be no doubt," Kay said very quietly, for he was pleased by the keen attention with which the whole assembly was listening, a murmuring arising in that stillness that was more exciting than the most delighted applause. "There can be no doubt that behind all the pronouncements of this court, and in my case behind the arrest and today's inquiry, there exists an extensive organization. An organization that not only engages corrupt guards, inane inspectors, and examining magistrates who are at best mediocre, but that supports as well a system of judges of all ranks, including the highest, with their inevitable innumerable entourage of assistants, scribes, gendarmes, and other aides, perhaps even hangmen. I won't shy away from the word. And the purpose of this extensive organization, gentlemen, it consists of arresting innocent people and introducing senseless proceedings against them, which, for the most part, as in my case, go nowhere. Given the senselessness of the whole affair, how could the bureaucracy avoid becoming entirely corrupt? It's impossible. Even the highest judge couldn't manage it, even with himself. So guards try to steal the shirts off the backs of arrested men, inspectors break into strange apartments, and innocent people, instead of being examined, are humiliated before entire assemblies. The guards told me about depositories to which an arrested man's property is taken. I'd like to see these depository places sometime, where the hard-earned goods of arrested men are rotting away, if they haven't already been stolen by pilfering officials." Kay was interrupted by a shriek from the other end of the hall. He shaded his eyes so that he could see, for the dull daylight had turned the haze into a blinding white glare. It was the washerwoman, whom Kay had sensed as a major disturbance from the moment she entered. Whether or not she was at fault now was not apparent. Kay saw only that a man had pulled her into a corner by the door and pressed her to himself. But she wasn't shrieking, it was the man. He had opened his mouth wide and was staring up toward the ceiling. A small circle had gathered around the two of them, and the nearby visitors in the gallery seemed delighted that the serious mood Kay had introduced into the assembly had been interrupted in this fashion. Kay's initial reaction was to run toward them. In fact, he thought everyone would want to restore order and at least banish the couple from the hall. But the first rows in front of him stood fast. Not a person stirred, and no one let Kay through. On the contrary, they hindered him. Old men held out their arms, and someone's hand, he didn't have time to turn around, grabbed him by the collar from behind. Kay wasn't really thinking about the couple anymore, for now it seemed to him as if his freedom were being threatened, as if he were being arrested in earnest. And he sprang from the platform recklessly. Now he stood eye to eye with the crowd. Had he misjudged these people? Had he overestimated the effect of his speech? Had they been pretending all the time he was speaking, and now that he had reached his conclusions, were they fed up with pretending? The faces that surrounded him. Tiny black eyes darted about, cheeks drooped like those of drunken men. The long beards were stiff and scraggly, and when they pulled on them, it seemed as if they were merely forming claws, not pulling beards. Beneath the beards, however, and this was the true discovery Kay made, badges of various sizes and colours shimmered on the collars of their jackets. They all had badges, as far as he could see. They were all one group, the apparent parties on the left and right, and as he suddenly turned, he saw the same badges on the collar of the examining magistrate, who was looking on calmly with his hands in his lap. "So," Kay cried, and flung his arms in the air, this sudden insight demanding space. "I see you're all officials. You're the corrupt band I was speaking about. You've crowded in here to listen and snoop. You formed apparent parties and had one side applaud to test me. You wanted to learn how to lead innocent men astray. Well, I hope you haven't come in vain. Either you found it entertaining that someone thought you would defend the innocent, or else... Back off, or I'll hit you," cried Kay to a trembling old man who had shoved his way quite near to him. "Or else you've actually learned something. And with that, I wish you luck in your trade." He quickly picked up his hat, which was lying at the edge of the table, and made his way through the general silence, one of total surprise, at least, toward the exit. The examining magistrate, however, seemed to have been even quicker than Kay, for he was waiting for him at the door. "One moment," he said. Kay stopped, looking not at the examining magistrate but at the door, the handle of which he had already seized. "I just wanted to draw your attention to the fact," said the examining magistrate, "that you have today deprived yourself, although you can't yet have realized it, of the advantage that an interrogation offers to the arrested man in each case." Kay laughed at the door. "You scoundrels," he cried. "You can have all your interrogations." Then he opened the door and hurried down the stairs. Behind him rose the sounds of the assembly, which had come to life again, no doubt beginning to discuss what had occurred, as students might. Chapter 4. In the empty courtroom, the student, the offices. Kay waited from day to day throughout the following week for further notification. He couldn't believe they had taken his waiver of interrogations literally, and when the expected notification had not arrived by Saturday evening, he took it as an implicit summons to appear again in the same building at the same time. So he returned on Sunday. But this time he went straight up the stairs and along the passageways. A few people who remembered him greeted him from their doors, but he no longer needed to ask the way, and soon reached the right door. It opened at once at his knock, and without even glancing at the familiar face of the woman, who remained standing by the door, he headed directly for the adjoining room. "There's no session today," the woman said. "Why wouldn't there be a session?" he asked, not really believing it. But the woman convinced him by opening the door to the next room. It was indeed empty, and in its emptiness looked even more sordid than it had last Sunday. On the table, which stood unchanged on the platform, lay several books. "Can I look at the books?" Kay asked, not out of any particular curiosity, but simply so that his presence was not entirely pointless. "No," said the woman, and shut the door again. "That's not allowed. Those books belong to the examining magistrate." "Oh, I see," said Kay, and nodded. "They're probably law books, and it's in the nature of this judicial system that one is condemned not only in innocence, but also in ignorance." "It must be," said the woman, who hadn't really understood him. "Well, then I'll leave," said Kay. "Shall I give the examining magistrate any message?" asked the woman. "You know him?" Kay asked. "Of course," said the woman. "After all, my husband is a court usher." Only then did Kay see that the room, which had contained only a washtub last time, was now a fully furnished living room. The woman noticed his astonishment and said, "Yes, we live here rent-free, but we have to move our furniture out on days when the court is in session. My husband's job has a few disadvantages." "It's not so much the room that astonishes me," said Kay, giving her an angry look, "as the fact that you're married." "Are you referring perhaps to the incident last session when I interrupted your speech?" asked the woman. "Of course," said Kay. "Today that's all over and practically forgotten, but it really angered me at the time. And now you yourself say you're a married woman." "It wasn't to your disadvantage to have your speech interrupted. You were judged quite unfavourably afterwards." "That may be," said Kay, brushing the remark aside, "but that doesn't excuse you." "I'm excused in the eyes of those who know me," said the woman. "The man who was embracing me has been persecuting me for a long time. I may not be tempting in general, but I am to him. There's no way to protect myself. Even my husband has finally come to terms with it. He has to put up with it if he wants to keep his job, because the man involved is a student, and will presumably become even more powerful. He's always after me. He left just before you arrived." "It fits in with all the rest," said Kay. "I'm not surprised." "'You'd probably like to improve a few things around here,' the woman asked slowly and tentatively, as if she were saying something dangerous for her as well as for Kay. "'I gathered that from your speech, which, personally, I liked a lot. "'Of course, I heard only part of it, since I missed the beginning, "'and at the end I was on the floor with the student.' "'It's so disgusting here,' she said after a pause, and took Kay's hand. "'Do you think you'll be able to improve things?' Kay smiled and turned his hand slightly in her soft hands. "'Actually,' he said, "'it's not my job to improve things here, as you put it, "'and if you said that to someone like the examining magistrate, "'you'd be laughed at or punished. "'I certainly wouldn't have become involved in these matters of my own free will, "'and I would never have lost any sleep over the shortcomings of this judicial system. "'But because I was supposedly placed under arrest, "'I've been arrested, you see, "'I've been forced to take action in my own behalf.' But if I can be of any help to you in the process, I'll of course be happy to do so. Not simply out of compassion, but because you can help me in turn. How could I do that? Asked the woman. By showing me those books on the table now, for example. But of course, cried the woman, dragging him quickly after her. They were old, dog-eared books. One of the bindings was almost split in two at the spine, the covers barely hanging by the cords. "'How dirty everything is,' said Kay, shaking his head, and before Kay could reach for the books, the woman wiped at least some of the dust off with her apron. Kay opened the book on top, and an indecent picture was revealed. A man and a woman were sitting naked on a divan. The obscene intention of the artist was obvious, but his ineptitude was so great that in the end there was nothing to be seen but a man and a woman emerging far too corporeally from the picture, sitting rigidly upright, and, due to the poor perspective, turning toward each other quite awkwardly. Kay didn't leaf through any further, but simply opened to the frontispiece of the second book, a novel entitled The Torments Greta Suffered at the Hands of Her Husband Hans. "'So these are the law books they study,' said Kay. "'I'm to be judged by such men.' "'I'll help you,' said the woman. "'Do you want me to?' "'Could you really do so without endangering yourself?' "'After all, you said before that your husband was highly dependent on his superiors.' "'Even so, I'll help you,' said the woman. "'Come on, we have to discuss it. "'Forget about my danger. "'I only fear danger when I want to. "'Come on.' "'She pointed to the platform and asked him to sit with her on the step. "'You have beautiful dark eyes,' she said, after they were seated, looking up into Kay's face. "'They say I have beautiful eyes as well, but yours are much more beautiful.' "'By the way, I was struck by them right away the first time you came here. "'They were the reason I came into the assembly room later, which I never do otherwise. "'In fact, it's more or less forbidden.' "'So that's all it is,' thought Kay. "'She's offering herself to me. "'She's depraved, like everyone else around here. "'She's had her fill of court officials, which is understandable, "'so she accosts any stranger who comes along with a compliment about his eyes.' And Kay stood up without saying anything, as if he had spoken his thoughts aloud and thus explained his conduct to the woman. "'I don't think you can help me,' he said. "'To be of real help, a person would have to have connections with higher officials. "'But I'm sure you know only the low-level employees who hang around here in such great numbers. "'Of course, those you know quite well, and you might be able to get somewhere with them, I don't doubt that, "'but the best you could hope to achieve through them would have no effect whatsoever on the final outcome of the trial.' And you would have lost a few friends in the process. I don't want that. Keep your present relationship with these people. It seems to me you really can't do without it. I say that with some regret, because, to return your compliment, at least in part, I like you, too. Especially when you look at me as sadly as you do right now, although you really have no reason to. You're part of the group I have to fight, but you're quite comfortable among them. You even love the student, or if you don't love him, you at least prefer him to your husband. That was easy to tell from what you said. No, she cried, remaining seated, and simply reaching for Kay's hand, which he failed to withdraw quickly enough. You can't leave now. You mustn't go away having judged me falsely. Could you really bring yourself to leave now? Am I really so worthless that you won't even do me the kindness of staying here a tiny bit longer? You misunderstand me, said Kay, sitting down. If it means so much to you for me to stay, I'll do so gladly. After all, I have plenty of time, since I came here today thinking there would be a hearing. All I meant by what I said earlier was that you shouldn't try to do anything about my trial for me. But there's no reason to feel hurt by that either, knowing that I'm not at all concerned about the outcome of the trial and would only laugh at a conviction. Assuming the trial ever comes to an actual conclusion, which I greatly doubt, I think it much more likely that the proceedings have already been dropped through laziness or forgetfulness, or perhaps even fear on the part of the officials, or that they will be dropped in the near future. Of course, it's always possible that they'll seem to continue the trial in hopes of some sort of sizable bribe, totally in vain, I can tell you right now, for I won't bribe anyone. You would be doing me a favour, however, if you would tell the examining magistrate or some other person who enjoys spreading important information that I will never bribe anyone, nor be brought to do so by any of the rich store of tricks these gentlemen no doubt possess. There's no chance of success, you can tell them that quite frankly. But they may well have realised that already, and even if they haven't, it makes no real difference to me for them to find out now. After all, it would only spare these gentlemen work, and me a few annoyances as well, of course, ones I'll happily accept, if I know that each is a blow against them in turn. And I'll make sure that that's the case. Do you really know the examining magistrate?
Of course, said the woman. In fact, he's the first person I thought of when I offered to help. I didn't know he was only a low-level official, but since you say so, that's probably right. Even so, I think that the report he sends to his superior still has some influence, and he writes so many reports. You say the officials are lazy, but surely not all, and particularly not this examining magistrate. He writes a lot. Last Sunday, for example, the session went on almost into the evening. Everyone left, but the examining magistrate remained behind in the hall and had me bring him a lamp. All I had was a little kitchen lamp, but he was satisfied with it and immediately started writing. In the meantime, my husband, who had been off duty that particular Sunday, returned. We carried in our furniture, arranged our room once more. Then some neighbours arrived. We talked a while longer, by candlelight. In short, we forgot the examining magistrate and went to bed. Suddenly, that night, it must have been late at night by then, I awake and find the examining magistrate standing by my bed, shielding the lamp with his hand so that no light falls upon my husband. A needless precaution, since the way my husband sleeps, the light wouldn't have awakened him anyway. I was so startled I almost screamed. But the examining magistrate was very friendly, cautioned me against crying out, whispered that he had been writing till then, that he was bringing the lamp back now, and that he would never forget the picture I made when he found me sleeping. I'm telling you all this simply to show that the examining magistrate really does write a lot of reports, especially about you, for your hearing was certainly one of the major events of the Sunday session. Such long reports surely can't be totally meaningless. But you can also see from this incident that the examining magistrate is interested in me, and it's precisely at this early stage, for he must have just noticed me, that I can have a major influence on him. And now I have other indications that he sets great store by me. Yesterday he sent me silk stockings through the student whom he trusts and who is his colleague, supposedly because I tidy up the courtroom, but that's only an excuse, because after all that's my duty and my husband gets paid for it. They're pretty stockings, see? She stretched out her legs, pulled her dress up to her knees, and viewed her legs herself as well. They're pretty stockings, but really they're too nice and not suitable for me. Suddenly she interrupted herself, placed her hand on Kay's as if to calm him, and whispered, "Hush! Berthold is watching us." Kay slowly lifted his gaze. In the doorway to the courtroom stood a young man. He was short, with slightly crooked legs, and attempted to lend himself an air of dignity by means of a short, scraggly, reddish beard he kept fingering. Kay looked at him with curiosity. He was the first student of the unknown system of jurisprudence he'd met on more or less human terms, a man who would presumably advance at some stage to higher official positions. The student, on the other hand, seemed to pay no attention at all to Kay, but simply gestured to the woman with one finger, which he removed for a moment from his beard, and walked over to the window. The woman bent down to Kay and whispered, "Don't be angry with me, please. Please don't. And don't think badly of me. I have to go to him now, to this horrible man. Just look at his bandy legs. But I'll come right back, and then I'll go with you, if you'll take me along. I'll go anywhere you wish. You can do with me what you like. I'll be happy to get out of here for as long as I can. The best, of course, would be forever."
She stroked Kay's hand once more, sprang up and ran to the window. Instinctively, Kay grabbed for her hand in the empty air. The woman did tempt him, and no matter how hard he thought about it, he could see no good reason not to give in to that temptation.
The fleeting objection that the woman was ensnaring him on the court's behalf he easily brushed aside. How could she ensnare him? Wouldn't he be free enough to simply smash the entire court, at least insofar as it touched him? Couldn't he grant himself that small degree of self-confidence? And her offer of help sounded sincere, and was perhaps not without value.
And there was perhaps no better way to revenge himself upon the examining magistrate and his retinue than taking this woman away from them for himself. Then the time might come when, late one night, after long hours of exhausting labour on his false reports about Kay, the examining magistrate would find the bed of the woman empty. And empty because she belonged to Kay. Because this woman at the window, this voluptuous, supple, warm body in a dark dress of heavy, coarse material, belonged to Kay, and Kay alone. Once he had overcome his doubts about the woman in this way, the low conversation at the window grew too long for him, and he rapped on the platform with his knuckle, then with his fist. The student glanced briefly at Kay over the woman's shoulder, but continued undisturbed. In fact, he drew even closer to the woman and put his arms around her. She lowered her head as if she were listening closely to him, and he kissed her loudly on the neck as she leaned over, not even really interrupting what he was saying. Seeing in this a confirmation of the tyranny the student exercised over the woman as she had complained, Kay rose up and paced up and down the room. Glancing sideways toward the student, he contemplated the quickest way to get rid of him, and so he was happy enough when the student, apparently disturbed by Kay's pacing, which had meanwhile degenerated into full-blown tromping, remarked, "If you're impatient, why don't you leave? You could have left even earlier. No one would have missed you. In fact, you should have left the moment I arrived, and as quickly as possible." This remark may have been an outburst of utmost anger, but it contained as well the arrogance of a future court official speaking to an unpopular defendant. Kay paused quite close to him and said with a smile, "I'm impatient, that's true, but the easiest way to alleviate my impatience is for you to leave. But if by chance you came here to study, I hear you're a student, I'll gladly leave you to yourself and go off with this woman. By the way, you have a lot more studying to do before you can become a judge. I don't really know much about your judicial system yet, but I take it that crass language alone, of the sort you're certainly shamelessly good at already, is hardly sufficient." "They shouldn't have allowed him to run around so freely," said the student, as if offering the woman an explanation for Kay's insulting remarks. "It was a mistake. I told the examining magistrate so. He should at least have been confined to his room between interrogations. Sometimes I just don't understand the examining magistrate." "You're wasting your breath," said Kay, stretching out his hand toward the woman. "Come on." "Aha," said the student. "No, no, you're not going to get her." And with a strength one wouldn't have expected, he lifted her in one arm and ran to the door, his back bent, gazing up at her tenderly. A certain fear of Kay was unmistakable in his action, yet he dared to provoke Kay even further by stroking and squeezing the woman's arm with his free hand. Kay ran along beside him a few steps, ready to grab him and, if necessary, to throttle him, when the woman said, "It's no use. The examining magistrate has sent for me. I can't go with you. This little monster," she said, stroking the student's face, "this little monster won't let me go."
"And you don't want to be freed," yelled Kay, placing his hand on the shoulder of the student, who snapped at it with his teeth.
"No," the woman cried out, and pushed Kay away with both hands. "No, no, don't do that. What do you think you're doing? I'll be ruined. Let go of him. Oh, please let go of him. He's just following the examining magistrate's orders and carrying me to him."
"Then let him go, and I hope I never see you again," said Kay in enraged disappointment, and shoved the student in the back so sharply that he stumbled for a moment, only to leap higher into the air with his burden in joy at not having fallen. Kay followed them slowly. He realized that this was the first clear defeat he had suffered at the hands of these people. Of course, there was no reason to let that worry him. He had suffered defeat only because he had sought to do battle. If he stayed home and led his normal life, he was infinitely superior to any of these people and could kick any one of them out of his path. And he pictured how funny it would be, for example, to see this miserable student, this puffed-up child, this bandy-legged, bearded fellow kneeling at Elsa's bedside, clutching his hands and begging for mercy. This vision pleased Kay so greatly that he decided, if the opportunity ever arose, to take the student along to Elsa one day. Out of curiosity, Kay hurried to the door, wanting to see where the woman was being taken. The student surely wouldn't carry her through the streets in his arms. It turned out the path was much shorter. Directly across from the apartment door, a narrow flight of wooden stairs led upward, probably to an attic area. They made a turn so you couldn't see where they ended. The student was carrying the woman up these stairs very slowly now, and groaning, for he was weakened by his previous efforts. The woman waved down at Kay and tried to show by a shrug of her shoulders that the abduction wasn't her fault, but there wasn't a great deal of regret in the gesture. Kay looked at her without expression, like a stranger,
wishing to show neither his disappointment nor that he could easily overcome it. The two had already disappeared, but Kay was still standing in the doorway. He could only assume that the woman had not only deceived him, but lied to him as well by saying she was being carried to the examining magistrate. The examining magistrate surely wasn't sitting around waiting for her in the attic. The wooden steps explained nothing, no matter how long one stared at them. Then Kay noticed a small sign beside the stairs, walked over and read in a childish, awkward script, "Law Court Offices Upstairs." So the law court offices were in the attic of this apartment building. That was an arrangement scarcely calculated to inspire much respect, and for a defendant it was reassuring to imagine what limited funds this court must have at its disposal if its offices were located where tenants who were themselves among the poorest of the poor tossed their useless trash. Of course, the possibility could not be ruled out that there was enough money, but that the officials grabbed it before it could be used for the court's purposes. Based on Kay's prior experience, that even seemed likely, and although such a dissolute court was humiliating for a defendant, in the end it was even more reassuring than a poverty-stricken court would have been. Now Kay could see why they'd been ashamed to invite the defendant to these garrets for the initial interrogation, and chose instead to pester him in his lodgings. What a position Kay was in, after all, compared to the judge who sat in a garret, while he himself had a large office in the bank with a waiting room, and could look down upon the busy city square through a huge plate-glass window. Of course, he received no supplementary income from bribes or embezzlement, and he couldn't have an assistant carry a woman in his arms to his office for him. But Kay would gladly waive that right, at least in this life. Kay was still standing in front of the sign when a man came up the stairs, peered through the open door into the living room, from which the hall of inquiry could be seen as well, and finally asked Kay if he had seen a woman there a short while ago. "You're the court usher, aren't you?" Kay asked. "Yes," said the man. "Oh, you're the defendant Kay. Now I recognize you too. Welcome." And he held out his hand to Kay, who hadn't expected that at all. "But there's no session scheduled today," the court usher said, as Kay remained silent. "I know," Kay said, and observed the court usher's civilian jacket, which, in addition to the normal buttons, bore as sole emblem of his office two gold buttons, which seemed to have been taken off an old officer's uniform. "I spoke with your wife a short while ago. She's not here any more. The student carried her off to the examining magistrate." "You see," said the court usher, "they're always taking her away from me. Today is Sunday, and I have no official duties, but just to get me out of the way, they send me off with a message that's meaningless anyway. And in fact, I'm not sent far, so that the hope remains that if I really hurry, I might get back in time. I run as fast as I can to the office they've sent me to, shout my message so breathlessly through the half-open door that they probably don't understand it, and race back again. But the student has moved even faster than I have, and of course he doesn't have as far to go. He has only to run down the attic stairs. If I weren't so dependent on them, I would have long since crushed the student against this wall, right here next to the sign. I keep dreaming about it. He's squashed flat a little above floor level here, his arms stretched out, his fingers spread, his crooked legs curved in a circle with blood spattered all about. But it's just been a dream up to now." "There's nothing else you can do?" Kay asked with a smile. "I don't know of anything," said the court usher. "And now it's getting worse. Up to this point he's just carried her off for himself. But now, as I've been expecting for some time, of course, he's carrying her to the examining magistrate as well." "Does your wife bear no blame at all in the matter?" asked Kay. He had to control himself as he asked this question, so strong was the jealousy he too now felt. "Of course," said the court usher, "she bears the greatest blame of all. She threw herself at him. As for him, he chases all the women. In this building alone he's already been thrown out of 5 apartments he wormed his way into. Of course, my wife is the most beautiful woman in the building, and I'm the only one who doesn't dare protect himself." "Well, if that's the way it is, then obviously nothing can be done," said Kay. "Why not?" asked the court usher. "Someone needs to give the student who's a coward a thorough flogging the next time he tries to touch my wife, so he'll never try it again. But I can't do it myself, and no one will do me the favour, because they all fear his power. Only a man like you could do it." "Why me?" asked Kay in astonishment. "Well, you are a defendant, after all," said the court usher. "Well, yes," said Kay, "but I should fear his influence all the more, not on the outcome of the trial, perhaps, but at least on the preliminary investigation." "Yes, of course," said the court usher, as if Kay's opinion were equally valid. "But as a rule, we don't conduct pointless trials.
"'I don't share your opinion,' said Kay, "'but that needn't keep me from dealing with the student when the occasion arises.'
"'I would be very grateful to you,' said the court usher, somewhat formally, "'not really seeming to believe that his greatest wish could ever be fulfilled.
"'There may be other officials,' Kay went on, "'perhaps all of them who deserve the same treatment.'
"'Oh, yes,' said the court usher, as if that were self-evident.
"'Then he gazed at Kay with a look of trust he hadn't shown before, "'in spite of all his friendliness, and added,
"'People are always rebelling.'
But the conversation appeared to have taken a slightly uncomfortable turn, in his opinion, for he broke it off by saying,
"'Oh, now I have to report to the law court offices. Do you want to come along?'
"'I don't have any business there,' said Kay.
"'You could look around the offices. No one will bother you.'
"'Are they worth seeing?' asked Kay hesitantly, but feeling a strong urge to go along.
"'Well,' said the court usher, "'I just thought you'd be interested.'
"'Fine,' said Kay at last. "'I'll come along.' And he ran up the stairs more quickly than the court usher. As he entered, he almost stumbled, for there was an extra step beyond the door. "'They don't show much consideration for the public,' he said.
"'They show no consideration of any kind,' said the court usher. "'Just look at this waiting room.'
It was a long hallway, with ill-fitting doors leading to the individual offices of the attic. Although there was no direct source of light, it was not completely dark, since some of the offices had been constructed with open wooden grillwork instead of solid wooden boards facing the hall, reaching to the ceiling, to be sure, through which some light penetrated, and beyond which a few officials were visible writing at desks or standing for the moment near the grill, looking out through the gaps at the people in the hallway. There were very few people in the hallway, probably because it was Sunday. They made a very modest impression. Spaced out at nearly regular intervals, they sat in two rows on long wooden benches situated on both sides of the hallway.
This book is continued on Disc 3.